explanations. After a few weeks of this, by magic or miracle, the concepts took hold. I retook the practice test. The advanced algebra was still indecipherable. It came from a world beyond my ability to perceive, but the trigonometry had become intelligible. Messages written in a language I could understand, from a world of logic and order that only existed in black ink and on white paper. The real world, meanwhile, plunged into chaos. The doctors told Mother that Sean's injury might have altered his personality, that in the hospital he had shown tendencies toward volatility, even violence, and that such changes might be permanent. He did succumb to rages, moments of blind anger when all he wanted was to hurt someone. He had an intuition for nastiness, for saying the single most devastating thing that left Mother in tears more nights than not. These rages changed and worsened as his physical strength improved, and I found myself cleaning the toilet every morning, knowing my head might be inside it before lunch. Mother said I was the only one who could calm him, and I persuaded myself that that was true. Who better, I thought. He doesn't affect me. Reflecting on it now, I'm not sure the injury changed him that much, but I convinced myself that it had, and that any cruelty on his part was entirely new. I can read my journals from this period and trace the evolution of a young girl rewriting her history. In the reality she constructed for herself, nothing had been wrong before her brother fell off that pallet. "I wish I had my best friend back," she wrote. "Before his injury, I never got hurt at all." Chapter 15. No More a Child. There was a moment that winter. I was kneeling on the carpet, listening to Dad testify of Mother's calling as a healer, when my breath caught in my chest and I felt taken out of myself. I no longer saw my parents or our living room. What I saw was a woman grown, with her own mind, her own prayers, who no longer sat childlike at her father's feet. I saw the woman's swollen belly, and it was my belly. Next to her sat her mother, the midwife. She took her mother's hand and said she wanted the baby delivered in a hospital by a doctor. "I'll drive you," her mother said. The woman moved toward the door, but the door was blocked by loyalty, by obedience, by her father. He stood immovable. But the woman was his daughter, and she had drawn to herself all his conviction, all his weightiness. She set him aside and moved through the door. I tried to imagine what future such a woman might claim for herself. I tried to conjure other scenes in which she and her father were of two minds, when she ignored his counsel and kept her own. But my father had taught me that there are not two reasonable opinions to be had on any subject. There is truth, and there are lies. I knelt on the carpet, listening to my father, but studying this stranger, and felt suspended between them, drawn to each, repelled by both. I understood that no future could hold them. No destiny could tolerate him and her. I would remain a child in perpetuity, always, or I would lose him. I was lying on my bed, watching the shadows my feeble lamp cast on the ceiling, when I heard my father's voice at the door. Instinctively, I jerked to my feet in a kind of salute, but once I was standing, I wasn't sure what to do. There was no precedent for this. My father had never visited my room before. He strode past me and sat on my bed, then patted the mattress next to him. I took my seat, nervously, my feet barely touching the floor. I waited for him to speak, but the moments passed silently. His eyes were closed, his jaw slackened, as if he were listening to seraphic voices.
"I've been praying," he said. His voice was soft, a loving voice. "I've been praying about your decision to go to college."
His eyes opened. His pupils had dilated in the lamplight, absorbing the hazel of the iris.
I'd never seen eyes so given over to blackness. They seemed unearthly, tokens of spiritual power.
"The Lord has called me to testify," he said. "He is displeased. You have cast aside his blessings to whore after man's knowledge. His wrath is stirred against you. It will not be long in coming."
I don't remember my father standing to leave, but he must have, while I sat, gripped by fear. God's wrath had laid waste to cities. It had flooded the whole earth. I felt weak, then wholly powerless. I remembered that my life was not mine. I could be taken out of my body at any moment, dragged heavenward to reckon with a furious father. The next morning, I found Mother mixing oils in the kitchen. "I've decided not to go to BYU," I said. She looked up, fixing her eyes on the wall behind me, and whispered,
"Don't say that. I don't want to hear that."
I didn't understand. I'd thought she would be glad to see me yield to God. Her gaze shifted to me. I hadn't felt its strength in years, and I was stunned by it.
"Of all my children," she said, "you were the one I thought would burst out of here in a blaze. I didn't expect it from Tyler, that was a surprise. But you, don't you stay. Go. Don't let anything stop you from going."
I heard Dad's step on the stairwell. Mother sighed, and her eyes fluttered, as if she were coming out of a trance. Dad took his seat at the kitchen table, and Mother stood to fix his breakfast. He began a lecture about liberal professors, and Mother mixed batter for pancakes, periodically murmuring in agreement. Without Sean as foreman, Dad's construction business dwindled. I'd quit my job at Randy's to look after Sean. Now I needed money, so when Dad went back to scrapping that winter, so did I. It was an icy morning, much like the first, when I returned to the junkyard. It had changed. There were still pillars of mangled cars, but they no longer dominated the landscape. A few years before, Dad had been hired by Utah Power to dismantle hundreds of utility towers. He had been allowed to keep the angle iron, and it was now stacked, 400,000 pounds of it, in tangled mountains all over the yard. I woke up every morning at 6 to study, because it was easier to focus in the mornings before I was worn out from scrapping. Although I was still fearful of God's wrath, I reasoned with myself that my passing the ACT was so unlikely it would take an act of God. And if God acted, then surely my going to school was his will. The ACT was composed of 4 sections: math, English, science, and reading. My math skills were improving, but they were not strong. While I could answer most of the questions on the practice exam, I was slow, needing double or triple the allotted time. I lacked even a basic knowledge of grammar, though I was learning, beginning with nouns and moving on to prepositions and gerunds. Science was a mystery, perhaps because the only science book I'd ever read had had detachable pages for coloring. Of the 4 sections, reading was the only one about which I felt confident. BYU was a competitive school. I'd need a high score, a 27 at least, which meant the top 15% of my cohort. I was 16, had never taken an exam, and had only recently undertaken anything like a systematic education. Still, I registered for the test. It felt like throwing dice, like the roll was out of my hands. God would score the toss. I didn't sleep the night before. My brain conjured so many scenes of disaster, it burned as if with a fever. At 5, I got out of bed, ate breakfast, and drove the 40 miles to Utah State University. I was led into a white classroom with 30 other students who took their seats and placed their pencils on their desks. A middle-aged woman handed out tests and strange pink sheets I'd never seen before.
"Excuse me," I said when she gave me mine. "What is this?"
"It's a bubble sheet to mark your answers."
"How does it work?" I said.
"It's the same as any other bubble sheet." She began to move away from me, visibly irritated, as if I were playing a prank.
"I've never used one before."
She appraised me for a moment.
Fill in the bubble of the correct answer, she said. Blacken it completely. Understand? The test began. I'd never sat at a desk for 4 hours in a room full of people. The noise was unbelievable, yet I seemed to be the only person who heard it, who couldn't divert her attention from the rustle of turning pages and the scratch of pencils on paper. When it was over, I suspected that I'd failed the math, and I was positive that I'd failed the science. My answers for the science portion couldn't even be called guesses. They were random, just patterns of dots on that strange pink sheet. I drove home. I felt stupid, but more than stupid, I felt ridiculous. Now that I'd seen the other students, watched them march into the classroom in neat rows, claim their seats, and calmly fill in their answers as if they were performing a practiced routine, it seemed absurd that I had thought I could score in the top 15%. That was their world. I stepped into overalls and returned to mine. There was an unusually hot day that spring, and Luke and I spent it hauling purlins, the iron beams that run horizontally along the length of a roof. The purlins were heavy and the sun relentless. Sweat dripped from our noses and onto the painted iron. Luke slipped out of his shirt, grabbed hold of the sleeves, and tore them, leaving huge gashes a breeze could pass through. I wouldn't have dreamed of doing anything so radical, but after the 20th purlin, my back was sticky with sweat, and I flapped my t-shirt to make a fan, then rolled up my sleeves until an inch of my shoulders was visible. When Dad saw me a few minutes later, he strode over and yanked the sleeves down.
"This ain't a whorehouse," he said.
I watched him walk away, and mechanically, as if I weren't making the decision, re-rolled them. He returned an hour later, and when he caught sight of me, he paused mid-step, confused. He'd told me what to do, and I hadn't done it. He stood uncertainly for a moment, then crossed over to me, took hold of both sleeves, and jerked them down. He didn't make it 10 steps before I'd rolled them up again. I wanted to obey. I meant to. But the afternoon was so hot, the breeze on my arms so welcome. It was just a few inches. I was covered from my temples to my toes in grime. It would take me half an hour that night to dig the black dirt out of my nostrils and ears. I didn't feel much like an object of desire or temptation. I felt like a human forklift. How could an inch of skin matter? I was hoarding my paychecks in case I needed the money for tuition. Dad noticed and started charging me for small things. Mother had gone back to buying insurance after the second car accident, and Dad said I should pay my share, so I did. Then he wanted more for registration.
"These government fees will break you," he said as I handed him the cash.
That satisfied Dad until my test results arrived. I returned from the junkyard to find a white envelope. I tore it open, staining the page with grease, and looked past the individual scores to the composite. 22. My heart was beating loud, happy beats. It wasn't a 27, but it opened up possibilities. Maybe Idaho State. I showed Mother the score, and she told Dad. He became agitated. Then he shouted that it was time I moved out.
"If she's old enough to pull a paycheck, she's old enough to pay rent," Dad yelled, "and she can pay it somewhere else."
At first, Mother argued with him, but within minutes, he'd convinced her. I'd been standing in the kitchen, weighing my options, thinking about how I'd just given Dad $400, a third of my savings, when Mother turned to me and said, "Do you think you could move out by Friday?" Something broke in me, a dam or a levee. I felt tossed about, unable to hold myself in place. I screamed, but the screams were strangled. I was drowning. I had nowhere to go. I couldn't afford to rent an apartment, and even if I could, the only apartments for rent were in town. Then I'd need a car. I had only $800. I sputtered all this at Mother, then ran to my room and slammed the door. She knocked moments later.
"I know you think we're being unfair," she said, "but when I was your age, I was living on my own.
getting ready to marry your father. You were married at 16? I said.
Don't be silly,
she said. You are not 16. I stared at her. She stared at me.
Yes, I am. I'm 16.
She looked me over.
You're at least 20.
She cocked her head.
Aren't you?
We were silent. My heart pounded in my chest.
I turned 16 in September, I said.
Oh. Mother bit her lip, then she stood and smiled.
Well, don't worry about it then. You can stay. Don't know what your dad was thinking, really. I guess we forgot. Hard to keep track of how old you kids are.
Sean returned to work, hobbling unsteadily. He wore an Aussie Outback hat, which was large, wide-brimmed, and made of chocolate-brown, oiled leather. Before the accident, he had worn the hat only when riding horses, but now he kept it on all the time, even in the house, which Dad said was disrespectful. Disrespecting Dad might have been the reason Sean wore it, but I suspect another reason was that it was large and comfortable and covered the scars from his surgery. He worked short days at first. Dad had a contract to build a milking barn in Oneida County, about 20 miles from Buck's Peak, so Sean puttered around the yard, adjusting schematics and measuring I-beams. Luke, Benjamin, and I were scrapping. Dad had decided it was time to salvage the angle iron stacked all around the farm. To be sold, each piece had to measure less than 4 feet. Sean suggested we use torches to cut the iron, but Dad said it would be too slow and cost too much in fuel. A few days later, Dad came home with the most frightening machine I'd ever seen. He called it the shear. At first glance, it appeared to be a 3-ton pair of scissors, and this turned out to be exactly what it was. The blades were made of dense iron, 12 inches thick and 5 feet across. They cut not by sharpness, but by force and mass. They bit down, their great jaws propelled by a heavy piston attached to a large iron wheel. The wheel was animated by a belt and motor, which meant that if something got caught in the machine, it would take anywhere from 30 seconds to a minute to stop the wheel and halt the blades. Up and down they roared, louder than a passing train as they chewed through iron as thick as a man's arm. The iron wasn't being cut so much as snapped. Sometimes it would buck, propelling whoever was holding it toward the dull, chomping blades. Dad had dreamed up many dangerous schemes over the years, but this was the first that really shocked me. Perhaps it was the obvious lethality of it, the certainty that a wrong move would cost a limb. Or maybe that it was utterly unnecessary. It was indulgent, like a toy, if a toy could take your head off. Sean called it a death machine and said Dad had lost what little sense he'd ever had.
Are you trying to kill someone? He said. Because I got a gun in my truck that will make a lot less mess.
Dad couldn't suppress his grin. I'd never seen him so enraptured. Sean lurched back to the shop, shaking his head. Dad began feeding iron through the shear. Each length bucked him forward, and twice he nearly pitched headfirst into the blades. I jammed my eyes shut, knowing that if Dad's head got caught, the blades wouldn't even slow, just hack through his neck and keep chomping. Now that he was sure the machine worked, Dad motioned for Luke to take over, and Luke, ever eager to please, stepped forward. 5 minutes later, Luke's arm was gashed to the bone and he was running toward the house, blood spurting. Dad scanned his crew. He motioned to Benjamin, but Benjamin shook his head, saying he liked his fingers attached, thanks anyway. Dad looked longingly at the house, and I imagined him wondering how long it would take Mother to stop the bleeding. Then his eyes settled on me.
Come here, Tara.
I didn't move.
Get over here,
he said. I stepped forward slowly, not blinking, watching the shear as if it might attack. Luke's blood was still on the blade. Dad picked up a 6-foot length of angle iron and handed me the end.
Keep a good hold on it, he said. But if it bucks, let go.
The blades chomped, growling as they snapped up and down,
A warning, I thought, like a dog's snarl, to get the hell away.